Hello, Radioland. You are listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores, and this is another episode of Darshiv, the radio and podcast program brought to you by the Archives and Special Collections from the Yukon Library. I am Graham Stinnett, your usual host. However, today we have a special guest host, my colleague Kristen Eshelman, who is the archivist of the Northeast Children's Literature Collection. You will recognize her voice if you are a regular listener to this program. She had the opportunity to interview a close collaborator of hers who works in the School of Fine Art. Today we are listening to an interview with Janet Pritchard, who is a professor of photography, a photographer herself who has been honored and given many awards and fellowships, including a Guggenheim, which they will talk a little bit about in this interview. And she is also an area coordinator and graduate advisor in photography and affiliated faculty member of the Center for Environmental Sciences and Engineering and the Institute of the Environment at the University of Connecticut. There is also going to be discussion of a exhibition in which Janet's MFA, Master of Fine Arts, students have been coming to the archives this past semester in preparation for an exhibition at the William Benton Museum of Art. January 20th to August 2nd of 2026 is when that show will run. Be sure to check it out if you can. They have been working closely with Kristen as well as our other colleague, Melissa Waterworth Batt, archivist who helps them interpret and view materials relating to Horse Barn Hill is the subject matter, so a very local place on our landscape. The show is called Raid the Archive, New Eyes on Horse Barn Hill. Hope you enjoy this interview. Thank you for listening.
Hi, Janet.
Hi, Kristen. Nice to be here.
So glad you're here. Thank you for taking the time. We're sitting here in UConn's Archives and Special Collections here in Stores. You're very familiar with this location.
I am indeed.
And with this place, no stranger to it. And I'm wondering if we could start by you telling our listeners a little bit about what you value in collections like ours as both an artist and an educator.
Two different things to some degree. As an artist, I have used research in collections for some time with my work as a way to see differently. I often borrow the quote from Proust about the only true voyage of discovery is not in seeking new lands, but seeing with new eyes. And I want to see a landscape when I'm working on it differently. So I approach it as I see it now, but I like to have a deeper sense of how it came to be. And looking at artifacts in various archives and collections helps me do that. So it's as simple as that. What I didn't realize when I first started working this way was that not only would those objects, the books and the prints and the photographs and the postcards and the maps and so on, help me see differently, but my photographs of those objects would also become part of my work. That was a surprise that I found early on, and it was not something that I had intended to do. So initially my photographs were just of these things as a form of note-taking, as a way to remember what I had seen, to document it, so if I wanted to go back and look at it again for something else that I had perhaps missed the first time around, I could find it again. Because one of the biggest problems in our times, it's not a new problem, but I think the degree of it is different, is that with all these digital archives and hundreds of thousands of photographs that I've made over the years, it's difficult sometimes to find things. So developing a structure so that I could make these images as well, not only as note-taking, but as an aid to finding also became very important. Now, as far as teaching, my teaching with these sorts of materials grew out of my own personal research and creative practice. And I realized that the center here, the collection, was a unique opportunity for teaching. So I developed a graduate class. Although I had been bringing my undergraduate classes over for some time before the graduate course, to see some of the rich materials that you have in person rather than in reproduction, which is very important.
Right. So I'd like to spend a little bit of time talking about your work first.
Okay.
So I was on your website looking at your projects, the four projects that you have described on your website. And it appears that you've engaged archives for maybe all of the projects in one way or another. So you've completed projects in which you experienced the Connecticut farmland, Hadrian's Wall. You've been in Yellowstone, the Connecticut River. And in all of the projects, there seem to be these three elements at work. You have this geographical place, you have a location. You have the archival documentation that you engage with in some way. Maybe that's just some understanding of history. So you're going back to secondary sources for that. Or you're actually engaging with archival documentation. Or maybe even in the Connecticut Farmland Project, you're finding artifacts in the landscape?
Occasionally.
And then you have some visual form that you're, so your actual artwork, your response, if you will. You've described this method as my historical empathy method. So I'm going to read you a quote from your own website. My historical empathy method, looking for the places of intersection between nature and culture, informed by history and science, using archival materials to guide my search, remains unchanged. That was from Abiding River Project statement.
The first thing I'd like to say before we go any further is I did not come up with the term historical empathy to describe my work.
I see.
That was actually Professor Robert Gross, who's now emeritus.
Interesting.
Who is a historian of 19th century American social history, particularly centered on the Concord, Massachusetts area, with his book on the Minutemen and then the Transcendentalists.
And this is someone, if I'm recalling correctly, you've actually taught with.
Yes, yeah. Professor Gross and Professor Thorson and I developed an American Studies course some time ago for the Honors Program to be core curriculum on the book Walden and the Landscape.
So my question, I guess, is maybe a different one then, but tell our listeners a little bit more about your method. So what is this sort of intersection that's happening between
so it grew out of when I was young and in high school, I was not a particularly good student unless I was engaged by a subject, and I thought history was terribly boring the way it was taught. It was mostly wars and memorizing dates. And really it came down to economics more than anything else, in a way that was about power rather than about social structures and people's lives. So it didn't particularly interest me at that point. There was a course that I probably should have taken, taught by a very beloved faculty member at my school who had a wonderful Welsh accent, and it was on modern European history. And it was really more of an intellectual history than anything else, which I didn't know at the time. Then some years later, when I was an undergraduate, I did bump into several intellectual history courses, and those really caught my attention. So that got me thinking about history in a different way. And as I was working in various landscapes, my observations about not only what was there, but starting to wonder how that situation had come to be and how it impacted people's lives, started to become an interest that was catching my attention more and more. When I was in graduate school, I had to write a dissertation, which is unusual for an MFA program. And I wrote it on a book by the well-known photographer Lee Friedlander. But it was a lesser-known book of his. And every one of his books, he starts off with a quote from another book. And so to understand this book that I was working on more deeply, I decided to read the book that the quote was from. And that got me thinking about, it was a quote from the Makioka Sisters by Yunikiro Tanizaki, and it was on a moment in a stroll garden in Japan. And so I started reading about the history of garden design to try and understand why a stroll garden was the moment that he chose to preface this book, and ultimately came to see the book itself as a form of a garden. So that impacted my work quite a bit. And the thing I think about gardens that's so interesting to me is the stewardship involved and the fact that you have to work with nature to do a certain type of garden versus against nature to a different type of garden. So if you think about a Japanese stroll garden, the views are borrowed. So the way they plant it, what you see, and then what is in the distance behind it is working together. That's an idea that interests me tremendously. It's kind of like the Shaker idea of borrowed light in architecture, where you have interior windows to bring the exterior light in deeper into the interior space. And then, you know, as a comparison, you have Versailles, where it's clearly a garden intended to show power. Right. Mm-hmm. And so the ways in which a landscape is manipulated and what it shows about the thoughts of the people who've manipulated it and the needs and the desires in their lives and on all became very interesting to me. When I moved to Connecticut in 2001 to take a job here at UConn, I thought that the landscape would be very familiar. I had grown up in central New Jersey, which is at the edge of the glaciation. And so a glaciated hardwood forest, one seems like another to me. So I expected that. When I started walking in the woods, I found something very different. So I had to start reading about the history of the area. And so it starts with trying to understand a little bit about the geologist, but I'm geology, but I'm not a geologist. A little bit about the social history, the development of the mills in this area in particular, which come from the availability of water, which comes from the glaciation and leaving, you know, pockets behind in which it can collect. And all of those things are connected. So when I look at a place or a landscape, and a landscape is, in my mind, the intersection of nature and culture, I see not only what's there, but the presence of the people who have interacted with it over time, not just now.
Right.
And the bits left behind.
And then there's this mysterious, you thought of this linearly, there's this mysterious place in between that and then your visual form. You have somehow moved from that into some form that in your case is expressed through photography. What can you tell
one of the great challenges any medium one works in has limitations. So to choose photography for whatever reasons, and for me, I think some of the earliest reasons were just the magic of it in the darkroom and my ability to actually go out into the world, into places that I love to be, and come back with treasures. Right, which would take form in the dark room and actually be able to make something was very compelling. But the limitations of photography are such that you can only photograph the things that are visible. but you always want to photograph the things that are invisible, mm-hmm. right? So finding the ways to bring those two things together. And I use a variety of ways to do that, some of which are visual and some of which are textual. Mm-hmm. And there have been times in my life when I thought that I was relying too heavily on the text and not putting enough emphasis on trying to make things as much present in the photograph as possible. And I stopped myself from using text for a number of years at one point. But I always seem to come back to it.
In your Hadrian's Wall project and the Dwelling project, you described your technique as a hybrid of analog and digital. Mm-hmm. How does that fit in with your creation of this visual form?
Part of it stems, again, from when I was younger, and someone that I studied with in graduate school. There was a period of time in the history of American art photography in the 70s when a number of people came to photography from printmaking. And they brought printmaking techniques and ways of thinking to the medium that expanded it. And there's a long-running 20th century and even now to some degree schism, maybe mm-hmm. is too strong a word, but there are people who think of themselves as photographers, and then there's people who think of themselves as artists who use photography, mm-hmm. right? So bringing printmaking into photography, one of the things that it did, which is more aligned perhaps with art in some people's minds, was the presence of the hand. Mm-hmm. And so people were drawing. They were actually printing on top of photographs. They were sewing and stitching and making quilts and all kinds of different things. And to the degree that there started to be a series of courses in many universities called alternative processes, which mm-hmm. often referenced non-silver. So you were able to hand coat emulsions onto various materials, paper being the primary one, but it could also be onto fabrics mm-hmm. And photo transfers onto ceramics and wood and so on. So work often sometimes became sculptural, right? There were lots of different forms that really expanded it, and there were a number of exhibitions about this. And then people started building things to photograph, not just finding things. And also people started to work with abstraction very intentionally, which is very confusing for many non-practitioners, because the first question that most people ask when they look at a photograph is, what is it, mm-hmm. right? And you know what it is, it's a photograph, but that's not what they mean by the question, right? Mm-hmm. What they mean is, what is it a photograph of? Mm-hmm. So if you can't tell, then in some way of thinking, it can't really be a photograph, right? Because a photograph is something that is evidence. Although we know that that's very misleading in many cases now. Mm-hmm. Although actually we've known that for a long time, there were many practitioners in the mid to late 19th century who were manipulating their negatives. In fact, one of the photographers who worked extensively in Yellowstone that I came to know his work quite well would put black paper on his glass plates to black out the skies so that he then could take another plate with a good sky and put it in. So that kind of thing was very common,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I fully expected when digital started to make a rise in the photo world that people would then find ways to combine analog ways of working with digital ways of working, much like the influence of printmaking in the 70s. And I don't think it's happened as much as I expected, but it did have an influence on me. So I think that's where I think of it as being hybrid. Mm-hmm. So in the Dwelling work, for example, I'm actually making a film negative, although it is a Polaroid, and then I scan it, and then I manipulate the color in Photoshop. Mm-hmm. And then I make an unarchival pigment print, which is a long professional way of saying an inkjet print.
Let's see. You've mentioned the course that we've collaborated on, Raid the Archive.
Raid the Archive,
we're
yes.
now at the end of the semester of Raid the Archive 2.
Yeah.
2.0.
Mm-hmm.
The first Raid the Archive course was 2022 to 2023. And the MFA students explored the naturalist Edwin Way Teal's archive and created new work and had a show. And here we are again, trying out this idea between UConn Archives and Special Collections and the UConn MFA students. And this time around, we've been working with Horse Barn Hill, the location. So let's talk a little bit, help our listeners understand what is this idea of Raid the Archive? How did you come about this idea of having the students engage and then create work?
Well, one of the things that one hopes to be able to do, especially when you're teaching graduate students, is bring your own research, creative practice, interests into the classroom. And so having a course based in a research methodology that then becomes an exhibition at the Benton Museum is a pretty ambitious and all-encompassing process. In an ideal world, this course would be 2 semesters.
Yeah.
To be fully addressing all components. But the structure of the university also has limitations, and that would be too much to ask of a commitment from the students in the structure of the program as it exists. So we've compressed it, which means we make some compromises. But I think overall it works out pretty well. The idea itself... Well, comes from my methodology, as I just said, but also there was an exhibition in the late 60s at the RISD Art Museum, and they invited Andy Warhol to come in and curate a show from the collection and make some new work in response to that process, which is a method that many institutions have used since. And in fact, RISD, on an anniversary of that a few years back, brought in a number of other contemporary artists, and the show was actually pretty great. But the reason that show was called Raid the Icebox was because in those days the storage areas were not well temperature controlled, and so they were quite cold, is better, for, I imagine, for preserving the work. And so they called it the Icebox, so they just called the show Raid the Icebox. So we took that idea and ran with it with a small modification.
Yeah. So here we are, round two.
Yes.
We're not quite there. The show will be mounted, the exhibition will be mounted at the Benton in January, and it will run through the end of the summer.
Yep.
So,
in fact, I was just at another meeting with several of the students and Gary Krutzen, who runs our wood shop and metal shop, discussing frames.
Good. So what do we think? What do we think? How have the students done? Let's start with the students. Do you feel like this has been an experience that, you know, obviously these are developing artists, so they will maybe already have a method similar to this in their creative practice where they're engaging with research maybe as part of their creative practice, or maybe they don't. So how have they responded?
Well, research, especially, well, I can't say especially because I don't know. All I really know about is photography. So
yeah.
In the field of contemporary art photography in the United States, and also in parts of Western Europe, a research component has been on the rise in the last 15, 20 years. I think my journey, I've not been alone on my journey. There are other photographers who I know who have made a similar journey in the last 10, 15, 20 years. And so to expose them to that is important as an option. This course is offered as a experimental studio course, and the topic for that class changes every semester. So it gives the faculty an opportunity to engage the students from a variety of mediums in their medium in such a way that everybody can potentially succeed. Rather than strictly teaching conventional photography, for example, in my case, I need to introduce them to an aspect of photography that could potentially influence the art making of someone in sculpture and someone in painting and someone in printmaking and someone in ceramics and so on. I'm not sure if I've missed anything there, but you right. get the
yeah.
idea.
Yeah.
And so I think it's important for them to understand that this is a happening way of working now.
Mm-hmm.
It is a method that addresses a lot of concerns about connecting one's work to a vital understanding of the social and political situation of our times, as well as environmental in the case of these courses, which is something that concerns me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's been quite successful in that. Now, whether or not they continue to work this way, I don't really think that's a measure of success. I think the measure of success is the exposure to it as an option, becoming familiar with making your work in collaboration with professionals in other fields, such as yourself as an archivist and the staff people over at the Benton Museum, the curator, Amanda Duberly, Rachel Selinsky's...
I believe also an assistant curator.
Right.
Registrar.
Registrar,
yeah.
thank
mm-hmm.
you.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. and Carrie Smith, who's, you know, in charge of hanging it.
Yeah.
So, and working to deadlines
right.
and respecting policies and procedures at other institutions.
Right.
It's a lot of things in this particular class that I think in general just relate to being a more professional artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first time I taught it, I can speak to a little more definitively because that was 3 years ago. And in fact, that group finished with their MFA exhibition last spring. And I had the pleasure, and it really is a special time when you teach a group at the beginning of their program
mm-hmm.
and at the end of their program, whether they're undergraduates or graduates, because you can see the development
right.
and the growth. And I remember telling that group, as I did this group, that much of what they were learning, they wouldn't appreciate until later. And when it came time for them to work with the Benton folks to put up their MFA exhibitions, which is where that goes, they were in a very different position than they would have been had they not already had that experience with the RAID class. And they all, by the end of the semester, were thanking me and acknowledging that, yes, I was right. It did come into play, and it was very helpful.
And that, right, things went a little smoother,
yes,
maybe, than,
yes.
or quicker, maybe.
And they
yeah,
understood
yeah.
how to do
sure.
it in more
sure.
fully.
Sure. We'll help our listeners to understand that the two classes have been a little bit different. The first class, engaging with the Edwin Way Teal papers, the naturalist and writer, an archive with parameters, if
yes,
you will, a
yes.
very specific documentation of the work and also personal writings of Edwin Way Teal, a very large archive, lots of ways to enter into an understanding of Edwin Way Teal and his work in that archive, lots of different forms of archival materials. This time around, you know, we don't have a Horse Barn Hill archive, if you will, but we do, of course, have lots of documentation about the establishment of the university in this location and the response both in building on Horse Barn Hill as well as what actually takes place on Horse Barn Hill, right? So what part of the university's functioning is it a part of? You know, the documentation really could come from anywhere. We know that the students have used Board of Trustees minutes and they've used maps and they have been engaging with photography and articles in the newspaper involving protests around the use of the land and so on. That's a really different experience than focusing solely on a single voice, if you will.
It's a very different experience. I think that the first group, when they worked with the Teal Collection, in some ways had it easier because of those parameters. And sometimes when you make art, it's a little bit easier to get going if you have something to respond to.
Mm-hmm.
And photography as a medium is really, in many ways, an art of editing. And so if you don't have something to start with, you can find yourself quite confused. Mm-hmm. I also think the other thing that was an advantage in some ways for the students in the first group was that the Teal collection had some very compelling personal stories. And I think most people respond to people and stories. Mm-hmm. And with the Horse Barn Hill, we started with a place. Many people don't respond to place particularly powerfully the way I do. And so that was maybe a bigger ask. But in general, for both groups, to ask them to work this way was a bit of a big ask because it's something most of them don't normally do. You know, a lot of artists grow up finding their sense of worth in the world through making, not reading, mm-hmm. not math, right? But working with their hands and making things that have a presence in the world. And so to be handed a pile of papers
right.
to make some sense of is a very foreign thing for them. But I think overall in both groups, they've done an excellent way of finding a way in that is in some tangential way connected to what they normally do, which is what you would expect mm-hmm. and what I would hope for, mm-hmm. right? It's each person puts their own individual personal spin on things. Mm-hmm. I had some experiences, again, when I was younger, where I was fortunate to photograph, and this happened several times, the same place with multiple photographers. And to come away at a young age and see that each of us responded to that place in a way that looked somehow connected to the things that we normally did, mm-hmm. so that we each saw it differently. Mm-hmm. We each held it differently in image form. Let me know how much we bring to mm-hmm. seeing a place, mm-hmm. right? And so that's an experience that I understood well going into this process that I don't know that the students do, but we'll have a better sense of it from this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I should mention, because we haven't mentioned, the one other person who's been involved in this project, Melissa Waterworth Batt,
yes.
my fellow archivist and colleague here at UConn Archives and Special Collections. You know, our goal has, and it's true for everyone who enters the archives, is to just engage people's curiosity. And that's really what we're hoping for, particularly with the students. Some people come with a very distinctive research project in mind and they can just hit the ground running, but others come because maybe they've been compelled to by a professor or they have an assignment or whatever the case may be, but there's so much to engage with and we really want to encourage curiosity, and I think mm-hmm. this course is kind of about that as well.
Well, I also think that, and I know some people, this is certainly a valid way of working, but it is not my way of working. Years ago, I used to go to a location multiple times to photograph, and I would sort of develop what I thought of as a shot list, or a list of photographs that I wanted from that place. And I would go that day thinking, today I'm going to get number one and number four on my list. For mm-hmm. whatever reason, the sky was right, the time of day, the time of year, the whatever. And I would go, and I would have to make those photographs, and they'd be okay. But then once I finished with my list and I could stop and I could look around and I could absorb what was basically on offer that day, what that the possibilities were of that day unlike any other day and were things that maybe I didn't expect were richer. Mm-hmm. And I take the same attitude when I work in a collection. I have some sense of what I'm looking for, but I know that, first of all, whoever works in that collection has a far deeper knowledge of it than I ever will. So I think of it as a collaboration with the archivist, the librarian, the collection manager, whatever, and I give them some sense of what I'm looking for, and you know, they come up with things that I wouldn't have thought of.
Sure.
And that's hugely important, yeah. is those finds that are unexpected. Because those are the things that really broaden your understanding rather than meeting your expectations. And so I hope that they get some of that from this experience as well.
Yeah, I mean, one of the first things that I think we've done in each of these classes is to have sort of a conversation with students in the same way that we would anyone who comes to the archive, have really a consultation with the student to understand a little bit about maybe even what their current creative practice is, just to have something to kind of riff on. Mm-hmm. If you give me an idea, I'll have an idea, or I'll be able to point to something. It may not become relevant in the end, but
yep.
But there's a lot of connections that can be made.
That back and forth, that yeah. play of ideas is just intellectually stimulating.
Yeah.
And another reason, I think, why I love to work this way.
Yeah.
It isn't all just me.
Right.
Right?
Right.
It's other people. And that's also something I cultivate in the field. I spend a lot of time bumping into people, sometimes intentionally, other times accidentally,
mm-hmm.
and spending time talking with them. Recently, I was up in Massachusetts doing a lecture at UMass, and I spent the night so I could go out and photograph the next day. And I ended up at the turf grass research station for the University of Massachusetts and spent about an hour and a half with a man who was an emeritus professor who studied turf grass, and they were, he was measuring thatch that day. So I hopped in his golf cart with my camera, and we went out into the field,
uh-huh.
and he was digging up samples and showing me what he was measuring and why it mattered, and I learned a lot, and it was great.
Mm-hmm.
I love to learn about new things that aren't necessarily my field, that mm-hmm. enrich my work. I'm not a specialist in any of those things,
mm-hmm.
but I just feel like a sponge.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we're hoping the students have been feeling like sponges too.
I hope so.
We're going to find out,
yep.
For sure. What do you think's been particularly challenging for the students? Do you have a sense of that, even after the first round?
Well, I think the initial ask was shocking to them.
Mm.
They're like, we don't do this.
Mm.
This isn't making art.
Well, it's a lot of things. It's making art. It's mounting an exhibition. It's right.
Yeah, right. But the
yeah.
whole research part
uh-huh.
of it, the being
yeah.
in a library
mm-hmm.
or an archival collection, you know,
mm-hmm.
That's shocking to many of them.
Mm-hmm.
And also, well, for example, earlier I said I was in a meeting where we were working on frames for the current group. And Gary asked the students, you know, why Horse Barn Hill? And basically their answer was, we were told that we would do Horse Barn Hill. And I think that says a little bit about the attitude, right?
Right.
and I think it's a little bit of a hard sell in that sense, but I think it's important for them to learn that if you open your mind to possibilities, you can make interesting work about most things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been trying to kind of think about what is the difference between the way you would conceive of an idea and then find yourself in a location, and the way the students have been asked
mm-hmm.
to start with a location and then kind of work in response to that.
One of the things that I did to help them in this class and in the other version was we read a well-known article by a landscape, what would I say his field is? Maybe landscape architecture. And it's D.W. Meinig's The Beholding Eye.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much in line with that Proust quotation. And it's 10 different ways to look at a landscape. And so you take the same landscape, in this case, Horse Barn Hill, and how would a geologist see it? How would an agricultural resource person see it? How would somebody who deals with wood as a resource see it? How would a painter see it? How would a botanist see it? You know, how would somebody just strolling over to take a break from studying for finals? All those different ways of experience it. And then we also spent an afternoon on the hill with Professor Thorson, Robert Thorson from Geosciences. And I think his way of seeing the hill was very much a revelation for the students. And I think that is when they started to get a better sense of the possibilities of different ways of mm-hmm. seeing it. Mm-hmm. And I think that was a big help. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we could have done that with a lot more people from different disciplines, but the time limitations of the class really prevented that, unfortunately. Because mm-hmm. mm-hmm. there are a number of people on campus who have connected with the Hill itself or things connected to the Hill that would have also been equally compelling for them to hear about.
I shared with you that the landscape architecture courses, a few of the professors have had their students in the semester, and the outcome for those courses is obviously different. You know, they're designing mm-hmm. a landscape in a particular location, but they are starting from these local spaces, if you will.
Right.
In trying to get the students to understand more fully what's happened in these geographical locations on campus, for example, mm-hmm. what have these spaces been used for, and so on. So there is, even across other disciplines, a kind of similar approach to yep. Trying to get at whatever the ultimate goal is. Yeah.
Well, and trying to get students to get outside their individual experiences is mm-hmm. important for all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But, you know, the landscape architecture students are really doing client-based work, mm-hmm. which is very, very different. Mm-hmm. In our department, we have several areas that focus on what will, if the students continue in those careers, become client-based work. And so the training for that, mm-hmm. From an educational standpoint, is quite different.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever in your own practice, maybe you've never had this experience, you know, writers talk about writer's block, if you was ever sort of like kind of floating around wondering what the next project's going to be, does that ever happen? I don't know. You seem like the kind of person who always has an idea, but do you ever just sort of put yourself in a location maybe that you have not given much thought to, just sort of see what happens?
So when I was quite young, between undergraduate and graduate, I had a period where I wasn't making photographs. And I had recently had a very intensive period of making photographs. And then I was in a situation where it was very hard to do. And I thought that I'd lost it, mm. whatever it is.
Sure.
And I was freaking out. And I was like, well, I want to be a photographer, but I'm not making any photographs. Will I ever make another good photograph? Blah, 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 blah. And then I finally realized that even though I wasn't making photographs, what I was doing was reading obsessively and looking at things and listening to things. And all of those kinds of things I'd realized were basically, the way I put it is, I was filling the stew pot in my brain. Mm. And they were just simmering, and that they would come out. And after I did that once or twice in my life, I realized that that was just part of my process. So there's times of more intensive activity and times of feeding the stew pot for mm-hmm. me. But I always make photographs with a point and shoot or a cell phone or, you know, just everyday kinds of things. It's just my way of being in the world. Mm-hmm. But in terms of, quote, more serious work, mm-hmm. that tends to come more in spurts depending on scheduling and availability. I wouldn't necessarily have it that way if it was an ideal situation, mm-hmm. but life is rarely ideal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But putting myself in a situation where, well, the start of the Hadrian's Wall work was a family trip to Northern England, because we have a niece who lives there and is a historian and married to a third generation archaeologist whose family has studied a Roman fort just off the wall called Vindolanda. Mm-hmm. For three generations, they've dug this fort. And the family used to own it, and then with changing in economics, it's now a National Trust property. So we went to visit, and we went for a walk on the wall early on when we got there. And it's constructed, much of it, along a geologic uplift area, which presented a natural defensive boundary. And so the Romans took advantage of it to keep the Picts out from mm-hmm. the north, from Scotland, was now Scotland. And we were sitting up there, and I was looking at the remains of the wall that were almost 2,000 years old. And I was seeing this vital energy of the earth forming mm-hmm. in the uplifting, which to me felt like the Rocky Mountain region, which is one of my passions. But it was very green, although much deforested, unlike around here. But like the East, which is my Northeast, my other passion place, mm-hmm. and this strong sense of the human energy and the geologic energy coming together and feeling like the West and the East in some place that was neither, because the other thing that's so unique about that area and more like parts of the East than the West in the U.S. is it's human in scale. There are places out West where you know you don't belong.
Right.
You are very much a visitor. Whereas in this place, you know, you can go for a walk for a day and see tremendous terrain and go up and down and up and down, even if you're not in great shape.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Whereas to do that in the mountains out West, you had best be quite fit.
Right, right.
So it brought together many things. And I was sitting up there that first day and I was like, there's a project here
mm-hmm.
that I didn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
So it unraveled over time.
And that was a group project too, right?
Yes, yeah. It became yeah. a collaborative project with four of us from the Department of Art and Art History, a painter, someone who makes large-scale drawings, and two photographers. And the beauty of us being able to use mobile photography is that we were all on a level playing field. As far as technology, because the emphasis was on seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we made work yet again, each of us much in ways that related to the kinds of things that we normally did in whatever medium we usually worked in. And but we also could become a little bit competitive with one another mm-hmm. in a way that added a little spice to it. So mm-hmm. it was very much, each of our trips over there was like a little artist residency, and we had great fun working as a group and seeing the same place very differently.
Is that the only time you've ever done a project like that?
Well, I've done some shorter term ones like mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. which I mentioned earlier. When I was in graduate school, I was selected to be part of a project called America's Uncommon Places, which was sponsored by the National Trust. They chose 14 sites around the country, and it was sponsored by the Society for Photographic Education, which selected educators in the areas, and then the educators selected graduate students, which is how I got to be part of it, and then materials were provided by Eastman Kodak, mm. and then a large exhibition was mounted and a television show on it, and mm-hmm. it toured, and now it's in the collection in the National Trust.
Mm-hmm.
And that went on for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And we were in New Mexico, and we were asked to photograph a land-grant community called Anton Chico, which is comprised of five little villages, and it was fascinating.
Mm.
Again, there were three of us. We all photographed in very different ways, that if you looked at our personal work, you could see the connections.
Mm.
But not only did our photographs look differently, our way of engaging with it was different. And it involved a fair bit of history about the place and working with the local people to learn more about the place. And we found some historic glass negatives that we printed, and we had another exhibition with that because that wasn't officially part of the trust project. Yeah, I learned a lot. In fact, that was a very, very foundational and informative experience for me, I think, as to how I work now.
And before that, you were working in a different way, or they were sort of bits and pieces of...
I've always returned to places over time, return photography,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to repeat photography. Repeat photography is a very precise recreation,
mm-hmm.
whereas return photography is going to a place repeatedly over time to see how it changes over time and to understand it differently over time and to see how your work changes in response to those things has always fascinated me.
Mm-hmm.
But I wasn't as consciously connecting the history.
Mm-hmm.
I've always connected some landscape photography history with my work. I've always connected Well, probably not in high school and junior high when I started, but but once I got to be more serious, my work has always been informed by the history of my medium. But it wasn't until a little later that other forms of history started creeping in.
We should say that that's something that we've been able to do here at the archive with your students, is show them the sort of historical processes, and that's been something that,
that's been particularly able to, useful for the undergraduate classes.
That's been a good experience, I think, for all of us. And it helps us to know even better what's in our collection. This is why we love engaging with you guys, students and the professors, is because we do have the opportunity to see our collections in a different way, or even to explore our collections deeper in a way that maybe you don't on a sort of everyday basis.
Yes, it's so, not uncommon for me to email and say,
"That's right.
Have you got something like this?"
Yeah, right, exactly. Or do you remember this that we looked at?
Right.
Do you have more of that? Right, right, exactly. You have one luxury, I think, that the students don't have in your own work, is that you are not in such a compressed time period.
Oh, that's... Yes, very, very true.
Someone isn't holding you to the schedule of the semester. Your current project, the Connecticut River Project, how long have you been working on that?
That's embarrassing.
I'm not holding you to any judgment.
No, no, I do usually have other ideas in the back of my mind while I'm working on something. And it's one of the things that I was very interested in when I spent a lot of time with Lou Friedlander's work. He's published many, many books. And if you looked at the plate lists in the back, and you compare several books, you realize that he's never working on just one project at a time, right? And so I focus generally on one project, but it doesn't mean that other future projects aren't sneaking in and snagging my attention here and there. And it may show up in a more formal photograph, but it often shows up in my snapshots and my reading. I did a presentation once in Ireland for a class from the School of the Art Institute of Chicago that was at the Byrne College of Art, and I did a lecture for them, and the faculty member at the end of my talk said, how do you know when you're done with a project?
Yeah, the question in my mind.
Yeah. And I said, you know, I'm not really sure, but probably when I stop reading about it and acquiring new information. So yes, my these projects, these big ones, have unfolded under increasingly long periods of time, and part of it is just life interrupts. So the River Project was on my mind almost as soon as I entered Connecticut. And Connecticut is a place that I spent time when I was a child in the summers on the shore. And so I had a little bit of awareness of the river. My grandfather grew up in Wethersfield, and there's some stories about the river in his life. So that, that was there. My sense of the river on arriving in Connecticut was especially strong as sort of a socioeconomic dividing line. It seems more rural in the eastern part, especially the mid to the northern part of the state. And you know, you go west and you start to see the influence of money from New York more prominently. So that interested me, and all kinds of other things started to attract my attention, but I kept pushing it off, trying to finish the Yellowstone Project. But I was getting close to the end of the Yellowstone Project, and one day I was with a group of, I used to go on these pre-COVID, now it's become virtual, but I used to go on these retreats twice a year with nature writers, once up in New Hampshire and once out at the Cape in the spring, with slightly different groups of people. And I was, we were talking about work in the Cape one May. It was in 2017, actually, and I just, all of a sudden, it came out of my mouth, I'm ready to start the River Project. So a couple of weeks later, I went to the Shad Bake in Essex, sponsored by the Rotary Club, because the shad's an important part of the river. So I wanted to try shad and see how it was traditionally cooked. So that's where I started. But, you know, there's been some physical injuries. I had a very serious eye problem with a detached retina, and that took a while. Then there was COVID. And so, you know, and right now we have a 16-and-a-half-year-old dog who's not well. So it's hard to travel right now.
Yeah, that's the life gets in,
yeah,
in the
so
way,
Yeah, so life
right?
gets
yeah,
in the way. Right, and right. so you do what you can, mm-hmm. and you keep looking at work by other people on rivers. And I have a fairly extensive library of photo books and other kinds of books that I always, when I start a new project, I find a shelf in my library where I start collecting books related to it. And I've done that for quite a while.
Yeah, your Yellowstone project was published in the form of a book.
Mm-hmm.
And in these retreats that you've been on with the writers, are you writing as well?
Yeah.
Yeah, you are writing. Okay.
Yes.
Okay, in addition to
photographs. But I also show them photographs.
Yeah.
And I get a, you know, a different kind of eye on them, which mm-hmm. is always interesting. Mm-hmm. These are people who are very knowledgeable about parts of life that, you know, a lot of times in my work, there's little tangents that I feel are paths not taken,
mm-hmm.
right? Things that interest me. But I also grew up with a father who was, to me as a child, seemed to know something about everything.
Mm.
And I admired that greatly. Mm-hmm. And so I know quirky little things about a lot of different things. But as I said, I'm not a specialist in anything else but what I do.
That's enough, I think. You don't have to be. You don't have to be. Now that you've had these at least two experiences with this idea that about how to engage the students with research and the archives, do you have other ideas for the curriculum? What's anything percolating that's kind of making you think?
I have other ideas, yeah. but whether I will be teaching long enough to mm-hmm. do it is another story. Mm-hmm. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to share your ideas at all? Or what do you think?
I don't know that it's enough to sustain a full course.
Yeah.
But I really would like to do something with the Hewitt B. collection.
Mm. Yes.
It fascinates me that, and when was that? When I was over here, 2011, I think,
mm-hmm.
for the Digital Atelier project that I had going for a while, I photographed the, 1876 edition of the ABCB Encyclopedia by the Root family in Medina,
mm-hmm.
if that's how you pronounce it, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
A family that is still publishing that book.
Yeah, remarkable.
And still producing beeswax candles.
Mm-hmm.
And bees and beeswax and beekeeping are all things that fascinate me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a brother who keeps some hives. It's not something I would do, but it interests me. And there's one of the first things, I think it was Melissa told me about the Hewitt B. collection, was that even though most of the books were 19th century or early 20th, it was an actively used collection still because the information was still solid.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty amazing too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, be interesting.
I did make my own ABC from that book.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we thank you so much for being here with us.
Well, it's
today.
A pleasure.
Yeah,
it's just a joy to work with you all.
Well, we've loved
and
it.
And you are a hugely important resource for my teaching on campus. And I appreciate all the time that you all put into helping us.
Yeah.
And I hope the powers that be, that count the beans, appreciate what you've done for our department and the students at UConn.
Thank you so much for being willing to experiment with us, because we do have an idea about the archive as being maybe something more than research. We sort of love this idea of, I mean, sometimes I come into the reading room and sort of can imagine people in there sketching and doing other things that often doesn't take place in an archive. It's just a kind of working it out, no matter what your medium is or no matter what your, you know.
There are some institutions such as yourselves and the American Antiquarian Society, where I spent quite a bit of time working, that appreciate that possibility.
Mm-hmm.
There are other institutions that are less welcoming.
Sure.
For different ways of working. So I'm very appreciative that you all welcome that, because our students do work differently. And that's one of the things that I've had to learn to do to work this way, is to explain to people how I do work differently and what their resources can offer to me and what I can offer to them, so that I can engage them enough that they will allow me to work differently, mm-hmm. so that I can make the work that I need to make. Mm-hmm. And it's very much like, well, a little story about another well-known deceased landscape photographer, John Fall, whose work I admire greatly. He did a series of photographs, someone very well steeped in 19th century American pictorial conventions, in particular Hudson mm-hmm. River and Luminist and such. He did a series that was somewhat humorous in his mind of photographs of picture windows. Mm. And he noticed that most houses that had picture windows, the view through that window was something of note, or there was a reason to put that window there, mm-hmm. right? And so he was spending time out on the Cape, and it was off season, and he was able to break into a number of the houses. We shouldn't tell people he did that. But it was off season, and he was able to wander in easily and make photographs through those windows. Then he realized he couldn't keep doing that because it wasn't really...
Yeah, what a project.
It was going to be a problem. So he started walking up to people and knocking on their door and asking if he could come in and photograph through their window. And they would look at him all dressed in artist drag, meaning all black, and this strange person asking to come in their house, and they're like, no way. So he had to rethink this. So he got a new outfit, and, you know, he got some khakis and a bright colored polo, uh-huh. and he grabbed a copy of one of his earlier books, uh-huh. and he would Smart. Go to the door and introduce himself, and all of a sudden everybody started letting him in.
Right.
So learning how to gain access to the things, the places, the resources that you need to make your work is something that all photographers face.
Right.
Because it isn't always straightforward. There isn't always a how-to or FAQs for what you want to do.
Yeah.
And so your creativity extends to that part of it as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we certainly feel like that's what keeps the archive alive. We want it to be a living entity, not...
Yeah, that's very exciting.
Yeah, we're not here just to sort of steward and keep it safe, and that's kind of the
right.
end of it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and education is part of your mission.
Yeah, absolutely.
In a way that it isn't always with some places.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I've been turned down by a few places, not too many, and usually it's interesting. Often it's the smaller places.
Oh.
The bigger places, I can usually find a way to talk my way in and get somebody on the staff who's interested in what I'm doing and will go to their higher-ups and
right.
support it.
Well, I'm glad you've had success.
Super helpful.
You have some wonderful projects, and your ideas, as they've been extended to the students, I think are valuable. So,
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Absolutely.
I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. For more information on the archives and special collections, you can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and the web. Our theme song is Dream in Cassio Tone by Arable Lands. Graphic design by Melika Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.